All US presidential elections are, obviously, important. They're when American voters decide who should become the most powerful person on Earth. But due to the decision American voters made last time out, this one is more important than most. As of this broadcast, the US and the world might have to endure 4 more months of Donald Trump, or 4 more years. The difference between those outcomes will be made by the ability of the Democratic Party and its candidate, Joe Biden, to win on November 3rd. Recent history furnishes persuasive reasons not to bet your house on this outcome. In 2000, the Democratic candidate, Al Gore, lost a US presidential election by an effective margin of 537 votes in Florida. In 2004, with John Kerry topping the ticket, the Democrats lost again, this time by barely 100,000 votes in Ohio. After convincing victories under Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, in 2016, led by Hillary Clinton, the Democrats lost by fewer than 80,000 votes spread across 3 states. Had really very little gone differently, there might now be Americans in their 40s who had never known a Republican president. In this second episode of our series looking ahead to the 2020 presidential election, we'll be asking a few of the questions one hopes the Democratic Party has asked itself in recent years. Has the party learned anything from its mistakes? How do you beat Donald Trump? What do the Democrats have to offer beyond not being Donald Trump? How does Joe Biden keep a diverse party focused on victory? And, whisper it, what happens if the Democrats lose? This is The Foreign Desk.
Almost a century and a half ago, Senator Stephen Douglas told Abraham Lincoln, who had just defeated him for the presidency, "Partisan feeling must yield to patriotism." Well, in that same spirit, I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside. And may God bless his stewardship of this country.
We are required now to work together for the good of our country. In the days ahead, we must find common cause. We must join in common effort, without remorse or recrimination, without anger or rancor. America is in need of unity and longing for a larger measure of compassion. I hope President Bush will advance those values in the coming years.
We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests today are Amy Pope and Erin Haynes. Erin Haynes is editor-at-large at The 19th News, a non-profit, non-partisan newsroom reporting on gender, politics and policy. And Amy Pope is an associate fellow at the US and the Americas program at Chatham House and once worked at the White House as US Deputy Homeland Security Advisor for President Barack Obama. Amy, I'll start with you. The thesis behind this episode is, what have the Democrats learned? And so exactly that. What has the party learnt from those famous defeats in 2000, 2004, and most obviously in 2016?
I actually think it's not that useful to look at 2000 and 2004, partly because the party has changed so much over the last decade or so. If we were looking at 2000, we'd be looking very much at blue-collar workers, for example, and unions, which are still part of the Democratic base, but just not in the same way that they were. So I think it's most instructive to look at 2016, particularly given that it's the same candidate, and particularly given how surprised everyone was. And I think one of the key lessons here is that the party just basically took for granted key members of the constituency. They assumed that they would have voters in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. They assumed they'd have the working class voters and Black voters and Latino voters. And I think, you know, the takeaway is you can't make any assumptions. People need to know that you're actively working for them and that you're actively counting on their vote.
Erin, I'll ask you a similar question, but in a different way. A narrative has developed in the last 4 years that the reason the Democrats lost in 2016 was that Hillary Clinton was a poor candidate, that people didn't like her. And clearly there were people that didn't like her, because there are people who dislike every candidate. And there are people, doubtless, in America who had some sort of deep-seated problem with the very idea of a female president, whoever it was. But the fact remains that she did win the popular vote, and by a handy margin. Are there perhaps positive lessons that the Democrats could also derive from the 2016 campaign?
Well, yes. And I think another lesson to your point about her winning the popular vote, I mean, the only Democrat that has ever gotten more votes than Hillary Clinton was Barack Obama. And so, you know, there were certainly a lot of Americans who did like Hillary Clinton. And listen, we know that gender was a factor in her loss. I think that we continue to struggle with notions of electability in 2020, where there was not just one woman on the primary ballot cycle, there were six, you know, so six different ways for a woman to run. And yet still there were questions about whether a woman can win, as if that is not already a settled question in this country. But whether a woman can win the presidency, obviously, is something that is still very much unsettled. We saw questions of gender even creeping up in the veep stakes in this Democratic cycle as Joe Biden pledged to pick a woman, you know, the way that that was discussed, that kind of conversation was, there was a backlash to it, and that it was shut down early was certainly a positive. That attempts to try to other Senator Kamala Harris once she emerged as the vice presidential nominee frontrunner, the birtherism conversation kind of resurfacing and that also being quashed very quickly, I think is a lesson that possibly was learned since 2016. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there are positives, especially in the narratives that maybe have reemerged but are reemerging in a new environment that we can talk about. But also, you know, I think that what is unfortunate is that the reality for especially political journalism is that most of the gatekeepers, most of the people who are telling the stories about our presidential campaigns are still overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male.
Amy, I also wanted to ask you a question about the institutional culture of the Democratic Party, because all organizations of all kinds, they kind of develop a personality, they develop a character, which I think the individual members of those organizations end up buying into. And it's quite common among left and center-left parties to have this sense of themselves as occupants of the moral high ground, the plucky underdogs. We may never actually win elections and fix anything, but by golly, we're good people. Has an amount of that taken hold of the Democrats in recent years?
I think you're describing the Labour Party here, Andrew, not the Democrats. No, I mean, because I don't actually see the Democrats as the underdog. Obviously, I served in an administration where President Obama won re-election. You know, we had ups and downs in terms of approval ratings, in terms of congressional elections, but by and large, he left office with a lot of support. So I don't necessarily see it as that. But I do think that there, you know, to my earlier point, there has been a real evolution of what it means to be a Democrat. And the party is really grappling with that. Is it the labor movement? Is it identity politics? Is it, you know, and those actually create tensions between some of its members. I work on a lot of immigration issues, for example, and I'm really seeing it play out there, where the advocacy community on the left is really pushing Joe Biden away from more moderate positions and trying to push him to adopt much more progressive positions. And then sort of the moderate wing of the party being more uncomfortable with that. We see that also on police reform, on taking down the Department of Homeland Security. So we're really seeing a bit of a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party, not to be too hyperbolic. And I don't think that's been entirely resolved yet.
Erin, on that thought, because I suspect it's going to matter in terms of getting people to turn out and vote for the Democrats, that battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. Joe Biden might not be able to win that in the next few weeks, but he does kind of need to at least pause it until Election Day. And very obviously, he represents the safe pair of hands tendency. How does he keep that broad church under one roof between now and the election?
I think a couple of things could potentially work in his favor headed into November, you know, and I think the two things that are uniting Democrats in this moment. The first being something that I witnessed during the primary, where there was, you know, a crowded field of two dozen or so candidates. What I heard over and over from Democratic voters was that they were singularly focused on ousting President Donald Trump in November. And so, you know, for a lot of them, they were making a head versus heart choice and in choosing, you know, their nominee, but their priority was, you know, the candidate that they felt was best positioned to really defeat Donald Trump. And that was even before we got to the moment that we now find ourselves in as a country with the dual pandemics of coronavirus and systemic racism. And so that's really the other factor that I think Joe Biden understands is an advantage for him and something that he is probably going to continue to hammer in the home stretch here of the general election. And the pandemic is affecting all Americans, whether you get sick or not. This is something that is touching every single one of us. And that is something that presents a reality that all Americans are having to deal with every single day. And the response to the pandemic is something that Joe Biden has been able to contrast himself with against President Trump on a daily basis and is starting to really do that on the campaign trail and using that message in combination with the message that he launched his campaign with about this being a battle for the soul of America is something that could resonate, I think, with voters and really galvanize them even in the midst of a public health crisis.
Aaron Haynes and Amy Pope, thank you both very much for the moment. We'll have more from both of you later in the show. This is The Foreign Desk. If the Democratic Party has learned one thing the hard way in recent decades, it's that turning up is not enough to ensure victory. It's easy enough for any political party to come up with reasons why it should win, but how do the 2020 Democrats actually win, especially against an opponent who won't play by the rules? Here's Brian Klass, Associate Professor in Global Politics at University College London, Washington Post columnist, author of How to Rig an Election, and Deputy Campaign Manager for One Democratic Party Election Win, that of Mark Dayton for Governor of Minnesota in 2010.
The Democratic Party has learned a heck of a lot since the Obama years. The Obama years really revolutionized how the party operates in terms of pinpointing voters to a much more sophisticated degree, and Obama pioneered that for the party. So when we were working on the campaign back in 2010, one of the things that you would do is you would look at whether someone had voted, for example, in three of the last five elections or not. If they hadn't voted in that many elections, you sort of wrote them off because you didn't figure it was worth your time. Now it's micro-targeting, right? You're not just getting sort of the crude metric of whether the person voted, what part of the Democratic Party they occupy. Are they a climate activist? Are they somebody who's old labor, etc.? So the Democratic Party is much more sophisticated with its targeting. The real problem that it has that's new is how much division there is in the party in sort of what direction it's supposed to go in terms of progressivism versus sort of the old bread and butter of, you know, labor issues, working class issues, the sort of middle class message that you had from the Bill Clinton years. And this is showing up in a big way in 2020, right? Because Joe Biden is trying to find a way to win over the Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing of the party, and simultaneously wink at the centrists in the electorate who don't really care about some of the issues that are in the culture wars, but simply want to be sure that they're going to have their job and that middle class tax cuts might be on the table and that their health care will be provided for. So some of these issues, which are normally wedge issues in the party, Biden's struggle is to make sure that they get papered over before November 3rd. One of the things that I learned when I worked in campaign politics, the first day I was on the job, the candidate that I worked for, who then went on to become the governor of Minnesota, what he said was, all right, it's your first day on the job. We have 20 months for the campaign. We've already lost 40% of the electorate. We've already won 40% of the electorate. We're going to spend 20 months trying to win the 20% in the middle. And that's exactly how campaigns should think about persuasion, right? That there are only a certain number of voters who actually are gettable. And because of hyper-intense polarization during the Trump years, where, you know, nobody is really making up their minds about Donald Trump right now. They've seen him for the last 3.5 years. He's the most polarizing figure in American history, at least modern American history. Everybody sort of has an idea about whether they like him or not. So Biden should not focus a single second on trying to win over people who like President Trump and think he's the best president in U.S. history. It's not going to work. He has two things that he can do to win. One is he needs to drive up turnout. So that means you need to get people who don't normally vote, or you need to get people who are lean Democratic voters. In other words, you know, people who vote every other election. They may have voted for Obama in 2008, but sat out 2012 and 2016. If those people go to the polls for Joe Biden, he's going to win. And the second group of people that he needs to win over are the people who are genuine centrists, which is a small number of voters in American politics these days, but a decisive one, especially in the swing states that are going to matter come November. So we're talking about people who generally liked, you know, maybe Ronald Reagan, generally thought of themselves as small C conservatives, but don't like what Trump is as a person. Those are winnable votes still, and that's part of the reason why Biden's message at the convention was to try to have people like Governor John Kasich of Ohio say, look, I'm a Republican, but I'm voting for Biden because Trump is a menace to democracy. He's unfit to be president. And so the rub there is, of course, how do you win over the centrists without convincing the far left of the party that Biden is not really a progressive? Now, that's a very difficult question, but the point is that strategically, you need to focus on the voters who don't always turn out and the ones that you can actually convert to your cause. So if you look at the Electoral College map, there is a very straightforward pathway for Biden to reverse the fortunes of Hillary Clinton in 2016, and that's just simply to win back the states that normally are in the Democratic camp, and that is Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. That's clearly one strategy. It's something that the Biden campaign is working on. It looks like from the polls, and again, you know, things can change, but it looks like right now that Michigan and Wisconsin are pretty clearly leaning towards Biden. Pennsylvania, a little bit less clear, but also still leaning Biden. So that's the most straightforward path to victory. But there have been demographic changes, and there's also a difference because of the pandemic that makes the map wider for Biden. And this basically goes through the southern states of Florida, Georgia, and Arizona. And Florida and Arizona both have some similarities. One of them is that they have elderly populations that go there to retire because it's nice and hot. That matters a lot because the pandemic disproportionately kills older people, and President Trump is not trusted by most people to put their public health needs above the needs of the economy. So Biden is making inroads among older voters in a way that Hillary Clinton didn't in 2016. And the second is Hispanic voters. And this is one area where Biden needs to pay attention because he is underperforming Hillary Clinton in Miami-Dade County, where Clinton won by about 30 points among those voters, and Biden currently is winning by about 17 points among those voters. So, you know, even though he's doing well with that group, he needs to do as well as Clinton and then also run up the margins with elderly voters if he wants to win Florida cleanly. Now, if he wins Florida, it's ball game over, right? If he wins Florida, he will win the election. So there's a lot of strategy that's sort of wrapped up in either go back for the Rust Belt states, the Midwest plus Pennsylvania, or try to, you know, carve a path through the southern state strategy of Florida, Arizona, Georgia. The broader point here, though, is that Biden has many, many pathways to victory. Right? If you look at the swing states on the map, the only swing state from 2016 that could possibly switch from blue to red, in other words, from Clinton to Trump, is Minnesota, where I'm from. And I don't think that's likely to happen, but it's literally the only 2016 Clinton state that's seriously being talked about as in play. If you flip the map and you look at the states that Trump won in 2016 that Biden could win, there's about 10 candidates that are plausible. So Trump has his best case scenario at this point is a narrow win where he loses the popular vote, wins the Electoral College just like he did in 2016. Biden still has the possibility of winning a landslide in both. What will happen in the next 8 weeks, we don't know, but there are many, many states still in play. Trump's entire strategy for the last 4 years has focused on painting the Democrats as socialists, on going after them based on misogyny or going after them based on race, right? With Hillary Clinton, you had the idea that, you know, she was a woman candidate who wasn't up to the job. In primary foils like Elizabeth Warren, he used the same thing. Of course, he loves using the race card against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ilhan Omar, etc. And the socialist card would have been played against Bernie Sanders. With Joe Biden, none of those plays work, right? You can't go after him for being a socialist. Everybody knows he's a centrist, and he's an old white man. And so a lot of the Trump playbook simply doesn't work against him. Now, because of that, any sort of reaction that's an overreaction would be a mistake. People already trust Biden. He should accept that he has trust of the American people and not allow him to get sidetracked or baited into some sort of battle with President Trump about how much he can denounce Black Lives Matter protesters or how much he can say, you know, we're going to lock up and throw away the key anyone who protests in America, in Portland, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, whatever it is. And I think that's the real message that his campaign needs to take on board, is that what he's doing right now is working and he needs to stay the course, albeit with a bit more visibility and a bit more aggressive attacks against President Trump and the last 3.5 years that have been America's dystopia.
That was Brian Klass. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Still with me are Amy Pope and Erin Haynes. In this part of the show, I want to talk about the future of the Democratic Party beyond Election Day. Now, last week, when we discussed the Republican Party, we started with looking at what might happen if the Republicans win and what might happen if they lost. So I want to do the same for the Democrats. And Amy, I'll come to you first, and I'll put to you the scenario the Democrats don't want to countenance, which is, of course, that if Joe Biden contrives to lose on Election Day, they would then be the party that lost twice to Donald Trump. What would be the way back from that for the Democrats?
Well, first of all, if that happens, I think we see a fundamental and more permanent change in the way that the U.S. does business on the world stage, the way it manages its response to crisis, the way it manages the courts and the Justice Department and everywhere else, right? So I think we should not underestimate the impact of a loss to Donald Trump. And almost, you know, I can't move much past that. That said, I think, again, the party needs to stay focused on these kitchen table issues. Most people care about, can my child get a decent education? Will he or she be safe when she or he goes to school? Will I be able to afford healthcare? If I get sick, will I lose my job? What will happen? And I think the more that we can speak to those issues and persuade people that these are the primary issues that Democrats really care for and stand for, the more likely it will be successful. There will be a real reckoning if we don't win. But, you know, I think people have always found Donald Trump to be a bit of an outlier. He can say and do things that are so far from traditional politics as usual that I'm not sure it's that instructive to pay attention to him, but more instructive to pay attention to how well is the party addressing the fundamental needs of its constituents.
Okay, Erin, let's look at the other scenario, of course, which is that Joe Biden wins. I mean, there is, I suppose, the theoretical possibility of an electoral college draw, but that, I suspect, is a whole other program. So Joe Biden wins. What sense do you get of the kind of presidency he would be able to put together? Would it be anything exciting and transformative, or would his place in history basically be as the guy who wasn't Donald Trump?
Well, you know, Andrew, it's interesting because I think win or lose, to Amy's point, I think that a kitchen table issue for whoever the next Democrat to be president of the United States is going to have to be racism. Racism is on the ballot and it is on the hearts and minds of so many voters in this moment, as it should be, because race really is the unfinished business of our democracy. And I think that that is something that you are seeing both in terms of the systemic inequality unleashed by this pandemic, and the systemic inequality that has reared its ugly head in the form of bias and policing, even in the midst of a pandemic. And so, you know, what so many Democratic voters, especially progressive voters, were saying during this primary is that incremental change is unacceptable. Structural overhaul of institutional racism is necessary in this moment. It's overdue and it's urgent, and it feels even more so with everything that this country has been undergoing over the spring and summer and headed into the fall. And so, you know, if Joe Biden wins, you know, the thing that was so remarkable about President Obama's election was obviously that he was the first Black president of this country, which was largely symbolic for a lot of people. But I don't want to say that there was not substance to it, but it was symbolic for a lot of Americans about who and where we were as a country. But then The racial backlash that frankly came as a result of his election showed us that we still have so much work to do. And so, you know, Joe Biden, as a white man in his late 70s, is somebody who has an opportunity to do that should he become the next president of the United States. And I think that that is something that could be striking about his presidency, and certainly something that would set him apart, not only from President Obama, but from all of the Democrats that have come, or so many Democrats, I should say, that have come before him. And so if I was going to say either way, it just feels like race is going to have to be dealt with by the Democratic Party one way or the other, win or lose.
Amy, you worked quite closely with Vice President Biden. Just reflecting on what Aaron said there, that idea that perhaps, ironically and counterintuitively, a reassuring old white guy might be in a better position to make those sort of transformative changes that Barack Obama felt constrained from addressing. Do you think he actually has it in him? This is not the first time, of course, he sought the presidency of the United States. This will be about his third go at it. Obviously, the timing is probably not ideal, but do you think he has the energy and the appetite and the ability to address big issues like that?
I think he does. And I think his track record demonstrates that he cares passionately about these issues. I think the real issues are going to be so much of this is resolved at the state and local level. You start with police reform, for example. It needs to be a change that's happening from the grassroots up. And so he can certainly set the tone and should set the tone to correct a lot of what has gone wrong. But when it comes down to really changing the dynamic here, it needs to happen across the government at many, many different levels. And so that's going to be a challenge, and particularly in places where we've seen really endemic racism and police misconduct. So that's a tall order, but I wouldn't say that it's not something that he is won't try to tackle.
I mean, we're coming to the end of the show, and I want to again echo what we did last week when we talked about the Republican Party, which is why I asked our guests to imagine who or what the next Republican president of the United States after this election might be, what they might look like, or even if that person is active in politics now. And Amy, I'll ask you first. I don't want to write Joe Biden off just yet, obviously, but if you think ahead to the future of the Democratic Party, who might be on a Democratic ticket in 2028, say? And if it's not somebody who we know of now, what kind of qualities is a future Democratic president going to have?
Some of it depends on what happens in this election, right? This election, we saw the voters really coalesce around a very moderate candidate based on the assumption that that person could pull together the different strands of the party, and particularly at a time when the country is really facing such tumult and discontent. But I don't necessarily think that's going to be true. First, there's a real tug of war within the party over whether the candidate should be more progressive. I mean, it's really interesting to me that the last two men standing were Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. Very, very different points of view politically. But that suggests that there's a very considerable contingency on the left who may be better represented in the party in the future. It's hard to predict without seeing how this one goes. The one thing I'm confident of is that the candidate will be younger. And it's really important that the Democratic Party really have some leadership in the next generation for so many reasons.
And Aaron, I'll put that thought to you as well. Just finally, who or what do you see as the next Democratic president of the United States, either after Donald Trump or after Joe Biden? Is it somebody who arrived in politics as part of that 2018 midterm blue wave?
Quite potentially. But I think, first of all, to Amy's point, absolutely it will be somebody younger. It could quite possibly be somebody browner, right? We know that Congress is often the bench for primary candidates. There's currently in Congress the most diverse set of folks that you've ever had. And also, that person could quite possibly be a woman. The fact that Kamala Harris is on a ticket that could be victorious in November, I think expands America's imagination for finally the idea that a woman governing at the number two spot could potentially be governing at the top spot in our country. But even if not, just even the fact that from 2016, where you had one woman running, to 2020, where you had six women running, the way that we get, you know, our first woman president of this country, if that is the thing that is going to happen, is by more women continuing to run. And so I think that that is something that is only going to continue, and that that is something that could produce a female presidential nominee as soon as 2024 or 2028. So younger, browner, and female, I think, is what the next Democratic president of the United States could look like sooner than later.
Erin Haynes and Amy Pope, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced and edited by Yolene Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Mullett, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.